Veterans Radio is dedicated to all the men and women who have served or are currently serving in the Armed Forces of the United States of America. Today's Veterans Radio program is brought to you by the Marine Scholars Program at Ave Maria University. Go to avemaria.edu for more information about this great scholarship program. And the Village Kitchen Restaurant, located in the Maple Village Shopping Center in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And by you, our listeners.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Froneberry.
Good morning, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Froneberry, and joining me in the studio this morning is partner Bob Gould.
Oh, here Bob. I am. Yeah, I'm going to say hello to everybody out there. What is this, like our 700th program? We were talking about that this morning.
But I forget, what have we been doing? 9 years.
Yeah, if you go back to the time in July when we shook hands and got this thing off. Remember, we did it on a napkin. You know, they always hear that in the movies. Well, they wrote that script on a napkin. Well, we did. We outlined it on a napkin. Whatever happened to the napkin?
I think we probably wiped our face with it. I'm not sure what happened to that, but it's been a pleasure, of course, working with you, Bob, and, of course, our late partner Gary Lilly and Ken Rogie and some of the other people that helped us get going. We really do appreciate that. And especially we want to thank you, our listeners out
Absolutely.
There, for helping us
yep.
get on the air
yep.
and to stay on the air.
Stay on the air.
And if you'd like to help us out, of course, we're always like that. You can send your contribution to Veterans Radio at P.O. Box 3085. That's P.O. Box 3085, Ann Arbor, Michigan, 48106.
And our audience, our listeners, are responding. Mm-hmm.
They are. We got some very nice notes last week. I was just trying to find them, but, of course, in my disarray just before the program goes on the air, I couldn't find the note. But we want to thank the people that sent their contributions last week. It's great. Thank you.
And they keep saying, keep up the good work. And we were talking about that this morning, not just the good work. But I was talking to a young man last week, young guy, 23, 24. And he really had some disparaging things to say about veterans. Not that they were bad, but just some why are they special? Why are they different? Well, that's why we need to keep this message of what we have on this program. World War II is fading. It's going. If it wasn't for the History Channel and the Military Channel, how are the young people today? What is it, a chapter in a history book? Is that about it?
Well, if they're lucky if they can get to that. And as we mentioned this morning, I just think it's so important to get these stories out. We don't want these people to just disappear into oblivion. They did some amazing things. And as a result of what they did, you can go all the way back to the Revolutionary War. These young men and women that put their lives on the line to fight for a cause, to fight for a belief, to fight to defend what we have here. And whether you agree or disagree, just look around you. We've still got a pretty good country going here, and I'm getting a little tired of all the disparaging
Bingo.
Remarks about what America really is. Yes, there are problems, but we live in a democracy, and so we argue about our problems. We don't go around blowing people up and shooting people just because we don't agree with them. And I think that that's something very, very important for our listeners and for Americans to remember that, freedom of speech and freedom of the press and so forth that sometimes we get so upset at, that's what makes us different. And I think it's important that we remember that.
And that young man, he was young enough, probably the person who taught history when he was in high school, was even much younger than we are and had the same thing at World War II. Korea was not covered. Oh, heck, World War I. And how divisive that was, and how that was a prelude to World War II, and how that all tied in. And
Maybe it's because as we get older, we become more interested in how we got to where we are now, that we pay attention to those things. But in talking to history teachers and so forth, we go into a lot of high schools and talk to the students about our experiences while we were in the service, and they just run out of time. sometimes during the year to talk about specific conflicts, whether it's World War II, Korea, you know, the Forgotten War, Vietnam. Everybody kind of wants to push that to the side. We've been fighting this war on terrorism now for 10 years, 12 years.
12 years.
12 years. And when we get done talking with our guest today, it goes back before that. And I think it's important that we remember, whether you agree with the politics of whatever was going on, you still had our men and women that were on the front lines that were willing to throw themselves literally on the grenade to protect the country.
And it wasn't just during battle. There were folks that served during the Cold War, the so-called Cold War, and they did their job. They made sure that in the Fall de Pass there in Germany that the Russians didn't come down with their tanks and create all kinds of havoc in Europe. And we do, you know, and we were talking about that, folks. Dale and I were talking about that this morning, about we want to continue to tell the stories before the historians do. I saw something on the History Channel, and I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, wait, whoa, this was not the information that we at Veterans Radio, who had the actual guest, who had somebody on there who was part of that. And so we want to continue to do that. In fact, all of the media outlets that continue to do that, tell that story. Let's reach out to that youngsters and let them know what it is to be a military person. How about that? I like that. Well, I like what you said even better.
it's certainly
you're so articulate.
It's every once in a while we try to do that, but it's so important. We want to talk about, as we have said in the past, and as we read in a lot of books, you know, the ordinary people who do extraordinary things in the service of their country, just because. That's all. It's just because there's not any big deal going on behind it. It's what we think is our responsibility. You know, this is a special country, and I hate to, I don't want to, yeah, it's a special country.
Special.
And we've got to maintain it as being a special country. We're not like everybody else. This is not a homogenous world. We've got so many different cultures.
We don't have any kings.
In there.
We have no monarchy.
We got rid of the king.
That's right.
And that's why we got rid of the king.
And we fought a war to get rid of the king.
We don't have any dictators, and if we don't like who we've got in the White House, boom, he's gone in
four years.
You know, that's all you got to do the job, and who knows what's going to happen next.
I was talking to somebody else, too. This past week was very insightful for me, and I said, do you vote? Oh, no, why should I vote? Doesn't make any difference anyway. Well, you know what? That's awful.
Mm-hmm.
We had an election here in Ann Arbor, and it was decided by one vote. Mm-hmm. Remember that for mayor?
Yeah.
It was decided by one vote. No joke, folks. That really happened. And his vote does mean something, and I like the guy, and he is smart, and he's articulate. But to have that attitude, to stay home on that day when the men and women did what they did at Midway and Berlin
on the USS Cole. People that did that. People
just
that
did it. Just sitting did there it. Doing their job and manning the dials and the phones and the screens and every day and fighting off whatever they have to fight off and to just continue to do their job, make it all happen. We want to continue to do it. No, we do.
We're going to try.
That's right.
That's what we want to continue doing. So we continue to need your support. P.O. Box 3085, Ann Arbor, Michigan 48106. And our little transition now is once they've done their duty and they're coming back, they need jobs.
Jobs.
They need help. Jobs, jobs, jobs is what it's all about. And coming up on June 26th to 28th in Detroit, Michigan.
29th. I got.
Okay.
Okay. My press release. Well, that's
anyway,
an extra
Detroit
day.
Cobo Center. June 26th through the 29th, sponsored by the Department of Veterans Affairs, also sponsored by, helped out by the UAW, by a number of other employers and so forth, especially veteran-owned, service-connected, disabled veteran-owned businesses.
There you go, SDVOB.
Yeah, those guys are sponsoring this job fair. VA for Vets Hiring Fair is going to be held, as I mentioned, June 26th to 29th at Detroit's Cobo Center. they're expecting a crowd of at least 6,000 to come on down there looking for jobs. There are companies that are going to be there. There's going to be on-the-spot job opportunities, interviews, career searches for finding jobs, one-on-one counseling. And it's imperative that you register early, and you need to go to vaforvets.va.gov/Detroit. That's
oh, you better
VA,
do that again.
I know. vaforvets.va.gov/Detroit.
Why do they do that? Make it so complicated. Give that one
That's
more time.
That's for the young people. They can remember this stuff.
Okay.
vaforvets.va.gov.detroit to register. This looks like a great opportunity for those of you that are looking for jobs or looking for counseling, or if you know some veteran out there that's looking for a job, this is the place to go. We're going to be down there talking to people.
But we're not going to have a booth. We're just going to be down there. And in fact, if you live, within a day's drive, Cleveland, Columbus, Chicago, Wisconsin, right, you could come in too. This area. Now, where were you going to stay? You're going to stay, of course, in the garden spot of the Midwest, Ann Arbor, Michigan. I know I'm a little bit prejudiced, but while you're here and going to the conference, you can have a wonderful dinner at the Big Boy of Ann Arbor. That's at Plymouth Road and U.S. 23. You can't miss that spot, folks. That's like an intersection of two huge interstates. Yes, U.S. 23 and Plymouth Road, or better known as M for Michigan, 14. And while you're there, see Joe. Tell him, Joe. He's Portuguese. There we go. I was trying to think of that in Spanish, but he's not. And he will be glad to say hello. I just love the outside. This guy spends a lot of time. You know, you can always tell a good restaurant is how it looks, the bathrooms, and how the outside looks. So anyway, I just had to say that. So while you're coming here,
I'm not going to charge you for that one, Jim.
And I wait one more moment. I will have a program on the 23rd. Special guest. I can't tell you who that's going to be, but it's going to be very important. Yes, special guest for the conference. We're going to talk about that, and we're going to also have some people from the VA. Absolutely from the VA. Some very top folks right here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. But they're part of the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Okay. We are.
Oh, boy, we got all that in.
When we come back from our break, we've got a story that you need to be aware of and you need to remember.
Mm-hmm.
This is the story of the USS Cole, American Navy ship that was attacked in Yemen, and I think it's very important. We've got the commander of the USS Cole, Commander Kirk Lippold, on the program coming on right after this break. You are listening to Veterans Radio.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we are back on Veterans Radio, and we're going to be welcoming our first guest today. But first of all, I want to, for all of you out there listening today, if you have a question, give us a call here on Veterans Radio at 877-573-7825. It's 877-573-7825. On October 12, 2000, 11 months before 9/11, the USS Cole docked at the port of Aden in Yemen for a routine fueling stop. At 11:18 hours on a hot, sunny morning, the 8,400-ton destroyer was rocked by an enormous explosion. Our guest this morning is Commander Kirk Lippold, who is a commander of the USS Cole, and he's going to talk about what happened on that day in October. And, Commander, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the show.
So tell me about the USS Cole. What type of ship is the Cole?
USS Cole is an Aegis guided missile destroyer, the what they call the Arleigh Burke class of guided missile destroyer.
And how big is the Cole?
It is 505 feet long, 8,400 tons. There is actually almost two versions. There is an earlier version that started with the hull number 51, DDG-51. USS Cole was DDG-67, and those went all the way up to DDG-78. And then starting with DDG-79, they modified the back end of it and allowed for us to not just land and take off helicopters and rearm them and refuel them, but now actually keep them on board the ship. So all the modern ones have the ability to put up to two helicopters on board as well.
Wow. Things are changing rapidly. I was talking to the commander before we came on the air, and I said, we need to get a Navy person on this program so that we can decipher and translate some of the things that go on a ship. And I want to make sure I don't call it, a boat. That's not allowed.
Boats are either little small ones on board, or that's also commonly referred to as submarines. So,
right.
And I'll make it easy for everyone this morning. I promise not to use the term athwart ships.
Oh, okay. All right, I got starboard and port down. That's enough for now. Tell me a little bit briefly about your background, Commander Lippold.
Well, I was, like most young men and women these days, I was going to high school. For some reason, knew I wanted to serve my nation. It was just a deep inner feeling. And came from Carson City, Nevada, went back to Annapolis through the Naval Academy, graduating in 1981, chose surface warfare, which means ships like cruisers and destroyers. And actually, my first ship was a tank landing ship. And I went through a number of ships, a tank landing ship, a guided missile cruiser, guided missile destroyer. I actually helped build the Navy's very first Aegis guided missile destroyer, USS Arleigh Burke, in the early 90s, and bring that ship to life, which gave me a lot of extensive background in how the ship functioned, how its systems were put together, and then went on to be an executive officer on an Aegis cruiser out of San Diego, California, before taking command of USS Cole.
That's an extensive background. I did not realize the reason that I've got Commander Lippold on the program is that I was sent a copy of his book called Front Burner, Al-Qaeda's Attack on the USS Cole. And I have to say, Commander, that this book was fascinating to me. And, again, I don't have that much experience with Navy protocol at all, but you guys are really thorough. Can you tell our audience a little bit about the training that your crew went through even before you took off for the Mediterranean?
Certainly. You spend about a 16-month period between deployments where you're gone nominally 6 months, and you start out doing basic training where the ship works together as a team, learning how to make sure they can run the ship both in port and underway safely, work all the systems properly, learn how to do things like shoot the guns, shoot the torpedoes, run the engines, do all the safety programs. And then you begin to work with other ships doing coordinated drills, doing exercises, simultaneous both the missile firings as well as learning how to shoot the Tomahawk weapon system, which is our land attack missile that we use for shooting ashore. And then you start working with the aircraft carrier battle group and other units. So it's an incremental process that a ship and a crew go through to get greater experience at sea and in port working together with other ships so that when you go out and you function as a battle group, you can dominate an area of the ocean to ensure that we're safeguarding what we call those sea lanes of communication that safeguard not only U.S. citizens, but merchant vessels, specifically U.S.-flagged merchant vessels around the world.
Well, when you were deployed to the Middle East, you were part of, some battle group, I forget, 5th Navy battle group?
With the USS George Washington Aircraft Carrier Battle Group.
Okay. So you were deployed with them to the Middle East, and could kind of describe your voyage before you got to Yemen. I thought that was kind of interesting how you even got there.
Well, we left our home port of Norfolk, Virginia in early August of 2000. The George Washington and the majority of the battle group had actually left 6 weeks before us just because of rotation schedules. We would operate in the Mediterranean for a period of about 6 weeks, and at the conclusion of that, we would top off from an oiler, and then we would head across the eastern Mediterranean. We would go through the Suez Canal on the 9th of October, down the Red Sea, and at about 2 o'clock in the morning on the 12th of October, we're off this little port called Aden, Yemen. And part of the reason why we had to refuel in port while we were ordered into that port is we had gone from a Navy of 4,000 ships after World War II to a Navy of just shy of 600 ships at the height of the Reagan buildup in the 80s to a Navy that morning of only 315 ships. There wasn't an oiler within 1,000 miles of us. And because of that long transit across the Mediterranean and down the Red Sea and at fairly high speed because of the necessity to get us into the Middle East, we were below 50% fuel, and there were only two ports to pull us into, Djibouti on the east coast of Africa and Aden at the southwest corner of the Arabian Peninsula. And Aden was actually considered at that time the lower terror threat port.
Really? Because in your book, and again, we're talking with Commander Kirk Lippold, the author of Front Burner, talks about the USS Cole and what happened to it on that morning of October 12th in 2000, is that as you were approaching Yemen and the port of Aden, what were the procedures that you would go through for that?
Well, normally when you would pull into a port, you put in a logistics request for all of the services, which pier you want to go to, what fuel, how much fuel you want to take, which side you want to moor the ship to. We had laid that out all into a logistics request several days beforehand, but had not received any information back. And it wasn't until literally that morning that we even received diplomatic clearance to pull into the port. And there were a number of unanswered questions that morning. But as was our routine in most Navy ships, when you don't have a lot of information, you still pulled into the port, got tied up, shut down the engines, and normally the people from the port, the logistics agent, or the local police, if you were sending Liberty people ashore, which we weren't doing, they'll come aboard and brief you. Here's the status. Here's what we're doing. Here's how long you can expect to be here. These are the services we're going to hook up to you. So when we pulled in that morning, we didn't even know the pier we were going to pull into until we started up to go into the port itself. Then that was confirmed as we started pulling in. But it was fairly routine. Those are the way things worked back then. It was a pre-9/11 mindset because nobody anticipated, and we did not know, that Al-Qaeda had been in that port for 18 months already, observing Navy ships. And we were completely blind as we pulled into the port that morning.
Yep. Folks, you've got to read this story. It's fascinating. But the when you pulled into the port, you have to get Yemeni. Is that how you say it? Yemeni pilot had to come on the ship or harbor pilot to get you into where your refueling point. Is that correct?
Yes. Normally when you pull into any harbor anywhere around the world, you have an individual. He's called a pilot. And they're an individual that is familiar with the port itself, where the piers are, what the water depth is, what the tides are, and what the current is that actually moves the water around within a port. So they know how to safely get ships in and out of port to make sure that they don't run aground, that they don't have problems. They also communicate and contract with tugs to come out that will help guide the ship in and then help get it tied up to the pier. They arrange for line handlers actually on the pier to help tie the ship up. All those types of things are arranged and worked through this individual called a pilot.
All right. And so this was a contract that the American government had set up with Yemen to provide refueling for their naval vessels as they were going through, correct?
Yes.
All right. So now we're pulling into the harbor, and they wanted you to go in a different direction than you wanted to go. Can you explain that?
They did. They wanted to just get me in there, tie me up, and be done with me as quickly as possible, which we were going to tie up at a pier out in the middle of the harbor. We weren't actually even going to be close to land. And as we pulled in, just because this was a little bit higher threat port, we were working in the Middle East, and while there was no specific or credible intelligence information to indicate there was a threat, I still did not like that. So I took the time and convinced the pilot I wanted to turn the ship around to point it bow out of the harbor so that if there was an emergency, I could get the ship underway quickly if necessary and not be wasting time actually turning the ship in the middle of the harbor if, for example, we were under fire. And initially he was a little hesitant to do that, but I just persevered and calmly walked him through why, and eventually he did. So we were able to turn the ship around and moor at starboard side or right side to the pier out in the middle of the harbor with the bow pointed out so that if I had to get underway, I could.
And then you, as you're going through this refueling process, what else was going on at the time?
It was a fairly routine day. We were getting ready. The next day we were going to be meeting two Navy ships further up the coast to do turnover prior to entering. Excuse me. Prior to entering the Middle East. And the routine of the ship was just like it would be in port. We had no liberty, so it was very much of a work day. People were out doing routine maintenance around the ship. The one thing that did occur is once we started refueling, we expected a refueling rate of around 300 to 500 gallons per minute. That actual refueling rate to start was 2,500 gallons per minute. It was actually overpressurizing the fuel tanks. We had to have the workers bring that rate down to 2,000 gallons per minute. So instead of being there what we thought was going to be 6 to 8 hours, it turns out we were only going to be there for 2 to 3 hours. So we started feeding the crew early, getting the ship ready to get underway sooner than we expected, because if we could get into the fort and out of the fort that much quicker, from a Navy ship's perspective, we're safer at sea than we are in port. And knowing that and wanting to get that ship out as soon as possible, I was very happy about being able to get the ship underway in about 2 to 3 hours.
Well, I can certainly imagine that. We've got about 3 minutes before we're going to take our first break. And I wanted to ask you, in addition to the refueling, though, you were also taking on some supplies and getting rid of some garbage, correct?
We were. That morning we had arranged for sewage disposal to pump our sewage tanks out, and I had contracted for 3 garbage barges to come out to the ship. We figured we might as well get rid of the trash now rather than waiting. And 3 garbage barges, of those 3, 2 had come out to the ship. One was alongside in the middle of the ship. One was at the back end of the ship near the flight deck area. And the crew had brought up trash, had loaded those boats up. And about 11:15, those 2 boats left when the 3rd boat began to approach the ship.
Okay. Tell me about that 3rd boat.
Well, that 3rd boat had 2 guys in it. It followed a very similar path that the other 2 boats had. It came down alongside. The 2 guys in it stood up, waved at the crew. We didn't know, and we thought that was the 3rd garbage barge, came to the exact same spot in the middle of the ship where the previous one had been. And little did we know at that point that it was actually a waterborne improvised explosive device. It detonated. In about 3 milliseconds, it had blown a 40 by a 40-foot hole in the side of the ship, and we immediately began to take on water and list. I was sitting in my cabin doing routine paperwork that morning when there was that thunderous explosion. You could feel all 505 feet and 8,400 tons of destroyer violently and quickly thrust up into the right. We seemed to hang for a second in the air before we came back down in the water. The ship was bowing and bending in an odd 3-dimensional twisting and flexing motion. Lights went out. Ceiling tiles popped out. Everything on my desk came up about a foot, slammed back down. I had grabbed my desk in a braced position. It was that violent of an explosion. And as soon as I could let go, I went to the door in my cabin in the dark. I looked down. There were 2 emergency lights, one near my door, one halfway down the passageway or hallway there. The chief engineer ran by without saying a word, looked me in the eye, and went down to the central control station, which is like the nerve center for the engineering plant. I thought we'd had, like everyone else, we'd had a fuel explosion. A young officer comes out, looks at me, and asks, "What was that?" And then he runs into the cloud. He's going down to find out what's going on. I took one step and stopped, and in that moment, I knew we had been attacked. So I went back into my cabin, unlock the safe where I get the keys to the weapons, the missiles, the torpedoes, the 5-inch gun, and I pulled out a 9mm, loaded it, chambered around, decocked it, grabbed 2 cups of ammunition, threw them into my left front pocket, went down outside the ship. When I stopped at the halfway point and looked toward the back end, no one was around. I took a deep breath. There was dirty black water dripping off of everything. The wooden podium where a 3-person watch team was, they're gone, and the podium has been blown into pieces. And I don't know whether we're going to be boarded. I don't know whether there's going to be a follow-on attack. All I knew is that I was going to defend my ship, and I was going to defend my crew.
We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Commander Kirk Leopold, author of Front Burner, Al-Qaeda's Attack on the USS Cole. We'll be right back after this.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Chaplain Joseph O'Callaghan administered to the wounded and dying, led firefighting crews, and directed the jettisoning of live ammunition from his stricken ship. Details after this.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife.
My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
O'Callaghan was serving as chaplain on board the USS Franklin when that vessel was fiercely attacked by enemy Japanese aircraft. Calmly braving the barriers of fire and twisted metal to aid his men and his ship, O'Callaghan groped his way through smoke-filled quarters to the open flight deck and into the midst of violently exploding bombs, shells, rockets, and other armament. With the ship rocked by incessant explosions, with debris and fragments raining down and fires raging in ever-increasing fury, he ministered to the wounded and dying, comforting and encouraging men of all faiths. He organized and led firefighting crews into the blazing inferno on the flight deck. He directed the jettisoning of live ammunition and the flooding of the magazine. He manned a hose to cool hot, armed bombs rolling dangerously on the listing deck, continuing his efforts despite searing, suffocating smoke which forced men to fall back gasping. O'Callaghan inspired the officers and men of the Franklin to fight heroically and with profound faith in the face of almost certain death and to return their stricken ship to port. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
God bless America.
Back on Veterans Radio, and we are talking with Commander Kirk Leopold, who was the commander of the USS Cole, who has recently written his own book about what occurred there. It's called Front Burner, Al-Qaeda's Attack on the USS Cole. If you have a question for the commander, just give us a call here at 877-573-7825. 877-573-7825. For those of you that are listening to us on a computer, you can go to our webcast, and we've got found some really great photographs from his book and also some other ones of the USS Cole. So you just click on Watch Us Live. Commander, your ship was just blown out of the water, and you were, you know, come to the conclusion that you were attacked. What happened next?
Well, as I stood there watching all that dirty black water dripping out of everything with a 9mm gripped in my hand, I remembered that I had raised my right hand years ago in the courtyard of the Naval Academy, swore an oath to defend my Constitution, and I would be willing to give my life if necessary to do that. I was now faced with that moment. I took a deep breath, and I went out to the port side not knowing that this might be my destiny. Fortunately, it wasn't. I looked over the side. I saw the huge hole in the side of the ship. From there, we stabilized the security situation. The teams were already responding to it. I went up to the bridge of the ship. I asked the Yemeni port authorities to stop all harbor movements, notify local hospitals, because even though I hadn't seen any wounded at that point, I knew we were going to have some beyond ship's force capability to treat. I then asked them to send boats out to us, which they agreed to do. That was a very interesting situation where discipline paid off and training paid off, because as the boats came out, several of the crew initially were very critical that I was allowing boats to come near the ship.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't understand that larger picture, that boats were going to be necessary if we were going to save our shipmates who had been wounded. And so they were ordered to turn their guns away from the approaching boats. And it wasn't that they were ordered to turn them away. It was that we didn't want them to accidentally shoot a boat that was going to save our shipmates. So the Yemenis began sending boats to us. At that point, the ship was listing over 5.5 degrees to port and down 1 degree by the bow, which may not sound like much till you're standing on a ship with that much of a list.
Mm-hmm.
And then you begin to realize USS Cole sinking right beneath our feet. And if you could already hear people responding to it, I went down, and as I got to the middle of the ship, I actually was able to walk through the debris field. There was no power in the forward two-thirds of the ship. As I looked toward the back end, there was lights on, which was good news because that meant I had a generator running, which meant I could get power to pumps, which meant I could save the ship. But as I paused near the middle of the ship and went down the mess line itself, when I stood there, I could look down into the blast hole itself. There was literally nothing for over 20 feet in the ship. It was just this giant cavern. The area that had been our galley had been completely blown apart into four main pieces, the kind of triangular shape that blew in every single direction. And as I looked down in that hole, you could smell the thousands and thousands of gallons of fuel that were continued to be pumped on the ship for a few minutes after the blast till the Yemenis fuel workers shut it down. But it's what I heard that really worried me at that point, because down in that hole, you could hear the arcing and sparking of live electrical wires dipping in and out of that fuel.
Mm.
And fortunately, it never flashed a fire. I went to the central control station. The damage control effort was underway. And just to give you some idea of what had happened, when the explosion hit, the announcing system, or what we call a 1MC, had been knocked offline, and its backup system had failed. The alarm systems for the ship, because of a design flaw, did not work. That's why there was complete silence on the ship. There was no way to tell the crew where to go, what to do, or what had happened. Yet despite that, they had fallen back on their training. They had formed small teams. They had gone out, and they were already determining where the damage was, isolating the damage and containing it so that we could stop the ship from flooding and sinking. Those not doing damage control were immediately involved in the triage effort to save their shipmates.
How many crew were on the USS Cole?
That morning, 294 is the number I've got.
Wow. That's a lot of people that fell back on their training, which is normally what's happened with people in the military. It seems like in an emergency, you fall back on your training, which is it's a good thing that you'd spent all that time preparing them for whatever might have happened.
Well, it's one of those things, whether it's in the military or in any job or profession, you don't train so that you can think through a problem. You
mm-hmm.
train so that you can react and do what's necessary to save equipment and save lives. In our case, we were saving the ship and saving the crew. And within a matter of minutes, we knew the ship was not going to sink if we could contain the damage to the major areas that had been blown apart by the explosion. But knowing that, I could then turn to the triage effort, and I went up to the middle of the ship. My chief hospital corpsman, who's like a physician's assistant, briefed me on the status of the wounded that are lying all around me, and I was able to quickly ascertain, okay, he said, here's the priority order for getting people off the ship, and we immediately started doing that. But the way we had to do it initially was we had not put a gangplank or prow down to the pier. So the only way to get them off the ship was literally drag the litters that they were tied into over to the side of the ship, lean them over the side held only by ropes, and lower them down to the Yemeni fuel workers on the pier, who then ran them over to the boats and then got them on board.
Whew. This would make the hair in the back of my neck stand up when you're telling this story, even though I've read it. I'm amazed at the control, again, that the crew exhibited during this whole thing. The bomb went off right in your galley or kitchen or mess or whatever you want to call it for civilians, and it was right around lunchtime, wasn't it?
It was. The crew had lined up for lunch. The galley was up and operating. We had planned on serving lunch sometime or starting around 11:30. We actually began to feed the crew just a little bit before 11 o'clock. So the mess decks was filling up. Most of my chief petty officers, that mid-level layer of leadership on the ship, senior enlisted folks, they were in a little area just forward of the galley in their chief's mess. They were eating lunch. And so that would explain, I mean, we never found anything that indicated that Al-Qaeda targeted that area of the ship knowing it would be that time of day. What we can ascertain is they appeared to aim for that area because they would blend in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were also aiming that if you want to blow a ship up, you go for the middle and break it in half.
Right. Well, you mentioned later on in your book, and we're talking with Commander Kirk Lippold, and the book is Front Burner, that once the investigation got underway, that they had tried a trial run before, but had really messed it up, it sounds like.
Yeah, they did. Well, we didn't even know, but when we pulled in October 2000, there had been the investigation that the FBI would kick off along with the Yemenis would find that Al-Qaeda had attempted an attack in January of 2000. The boat was not as well built. The explosives had not been put in as well. It was somewhat overloaded. It went into the water and actually was swamped and sunk right there at the pier with the ship right there refueling, and they never detected it. And the intelligence community, more important, never picked up that this attack had been tried. And so consequently, Al-Qaeda came back, gathered up the boat, gathered up the explosives, tested them in the desert, went to a new safe house, built a gate, built up the walls, rebuilt the boat. And while 9/11 wasn't the day, USS Cole wasn't the target, we just happened to be the next one to pull into port after they made the phone call and said, we're ready to go, and they got the green light.
Just to put this whole thing in perspective for our audience, this was shortly after the bombings of the embassies in Africa. Is that correct?
2 years. Yeah, it was about 2 years afterwards. The bombings in the embassies had occurred in 1998, and this was October 2000.
And you never got any information or any intelligence that said to be extremely careful when you went into Yemen?
None. When we pulled in that morning, what we didn't know is we were essentially blind in that port. As a matter of fact, the embassy had closed down because of terrorist threats, yet we were never notified of that fact, nor were we given any additional security precautions to take as a result of those potential threats. And so when we pulled in that morning, there really wasn't any developed intelligence assets in the port of Aden that were being utilized in a manner that allowed the Navy to protect its ships pulling in there. We were the 27th ship to pull into that port. And when we pulled in that morning, we did so thinking it was going to be a fairly routine refueling stop, that there was no intelligence to indicate that there was any kind of threat there. There were a number of systemic flaws in how information got to commanding officers to allow them to make necessary force protection decisions. And consequently, while I was clearly put in the wrong place at the wrong time with absolutely the wrong or no intelligence to be able to make correct force protection decisions, I was blessed with a great crew that obviously did a phenomenal job in saving the ship. And as a matter of fact, when you read through Front Burner and some of the details that I go into, you'll look at it. We were able to actually get the ship stable and prevent it from sinking within about less than 2 hours. And in conjunction with that, the triage effort that's ongoing is really a shining moment for the crew, because we were able that first day to evacuate 33 wounded off the ship. We had done it in 99 minutes, and of those 33, 32 sailors would survive.
Wow. We're going to be taking a break here in a second. I want to come back. I want to talk a little bit more about some of your crewmen and what happened to them, and then what happened with the investigation as to what was going on. We're talking with Commander Kirk Lippold, the United States Navy, retired. He's the author of the book Front Burner, Al-Qaeda's Attack on the USS Cole. We'll be right back.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
We're back on Veterans Radio talking to Commander Kirk Lippold, the commanding officer of the USS Cole, and talking about his book Front Burner, about what happened to the Cole in October of 2000 when it was attacked by terrorists and a giant hole was blown in the side of the ship. And Commander, I guess I have to ask this question for our audiences. What were the casualties as a result of that attack?
Well, unfortunately, at the end of the day, the grim tally was we would have 17 sailors were killed and 37 were wounded and awarded Purple Hearts for their injuries.
And these people that were killed, I mean, if you can only imagine, I don't think we can even imagine being in a blast that huge, and the dedication and care that went into recovering their bodies, I thought was a very, very important and powerful portion of your story.
Well, you're absolutely right. We almost lost the ship Saturday night when our only operating generator quit, but we were able to get it restarted early Monday morning, and then we began the recovery process. The first day, there were five sailors that we had recovered that had begun that journey home to their families, but we knew we had 12 trapped in the wreckage of the mess line to galley and down in main engine room number one. By that point, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, along with Navy Criminal Investigative Service, were on board. They came together as a team and melded like you wouldn't believe into a professional law enforcement group. They're the ones that volunteered to actually do the extrications, and those guys working with the Norfolk Naval Shipyard and Mobile Diving Salvage Unit 2, over the next 4 days, we would one by one recover each of our shipmates. And as they came out, they were identified. We would put them into a body bag, drape them in the American flag, assemble the crew back on the flight deck, and then walk that individual back with three of their shipmates on each side, carrying them in an honor cordon, and the crew would come to attention, render a hand salute. They would go down onto the pier and be placed into a boat. I refused to allow them to be taken ashore by a Yemeni's boat, and so a cadre of Marines in a Zodiac would escort them ashore with an armed escort, and they would then begin that journey home to their families.
I found that to be a most powerful portion of the story, when your crew would line up after each body was found and brought out, and that they would go through that ceremony so many times. It really brought tears to my eyes, and I can't imagine what it must have been like for you and your crew to do that. It was a job well done, I have to say.
Well, it was one of those heart-wrenching farewells, but it's also a way that we could honor and pay tribute to an individual who, like all of us, raised their right hand, chose a mm-hmm. life of consequence and service to their Navy and their nation, and had died in that service. And it was the least we could do, because we also knew these people were going home to their families for the final time.
I think it's important, and I'm encouraging our audience to read this story, because you are really a traditionalist and a student of history when it comes to how things should be done, I think, is what I took away from your story, you know, with the history of the Navy and the traditions that were involved in there. And you ran into some concerns, I'll put it that way, with the bureaucracy of not only of the Navy but also of the government in general once this occurred. It didn't seem to be like such a big deal to some people.
Well, I think you're right. There were some people who were looking at the immediacy of the moment and were willing to give in to the political pressures that were being applied to the United States Navy rather than holding true to the traditions. I know that the one incident that you're probably referring to is I was asked at one point about 10 days after the attack to allow half or more of the crew to come home. Mm-hmm. They were having a very difficult time dealing with the issue. There was a lot of emotion involved. While we had just finished recovering the last of our shipmates, Elton, we were going to hold a memorial ceremony that evening. I was asked by a very senior naval officer to allow half or more of the crew to leave. And all I could think to myself is, I can't believe I'm being asked to allow my crew to abandon ship because it's hard.
Right.
And fortunately, that admiral, when I told him that he was absolutely wrong, that we needed to keep the crew on board, backed me, and it was subsequently backed in Washington, and I think for the right reasons. And consequently, the crew stayed together. While initially not happy, they now understand my reason for doing that, and I think they're very proud that as a crew, they stayed together on that ship, saved USS Cole, saved each other, and today they are as tight and bonded a group as I've ever seen.
I was thinking, you're right, that was the thing I was thinking about. And I was trying to, flipping through the book here, trying to find a line of whoever it was that said, do not give up the ship. And
Captain Lawrence at the Battle of Lake Erie.
That's what I, because I knew it was a local battle. We were familiar with that one. I think it's just great what happened with your crew and the way that you acted and the professionalism that was incurred there. Once the ship was salvaged and was being sent back, that's a whole other story we can't even get into. But you got to read the book to see the pictures of how they brought the USS Cole back to the States. It's an amazing story. I want to talk about the investigation afterwards because we're running up against the end of our clock already. So once you wanted to come back with the Cole, of course, and were encouraged by the powers that be to fly home with your crew. Is that correct?
Well, there was a lot of people who could see it both ways. There were people that said, when you're the commanding officer of the ship, you stay with your ship, period. And there were those that said, look, at this point in time, it's just a hunk of metal. The crew is really the ship. The captain should come home with the crew. Like you said before, being somewhat of a traditionalist, I got the unique privilege of speaking with our chief of naval operations, Admiral Vern Clark, at the time. And he said the decision was up to me. I asked him for his advice. He recommended I stay with the ship, and the decision became easy at that point. I was mm-hmm. going to stay with the ship. But a few days later, he thought that it would be better for me, in fact, to come home with the crew. So, you know, when a four-star admiral suggests you should change your mind, the answer to that is yes, sir. And
yes.
I did exactly that and came home with the crew. The investigation was kicking off at the same time. There were actually two of them. One was an investigation into my actions and the actions of the crew. The larger investigation by the Department of Defense to look at the vulnerability of units and ships around the world. And as that investigation was going through, I declined all media interviews. Part of what the responsibility is when you take command is that you live with the consequences when bad things happen as well as you do good things. And at the end of that investigation, while the investigating officer found a number of faults, there were some very senior people in the Navy who said in the larger context of what the ship and crew were put into, the commanding officer made the best decisions he could. There was no decision that I made that was assessed to have either mitigated or would have prevented that attack. And consequently, The investigation cleared me of wrongdoing. The entire chain of command was seen to bear responsibility to a degree for what had happened to the ship. And, that's how accountability works. I look at it today and say, look, there was one accountable officer that morning. That was me. And I look at how my ship performed before, during, and after the attack, and I am very proud of how well they did.
What were some of the changes that have been implemented since the attack on the coal?
A number of changes in the damage control. There were some equipment that has been upgraded on board. Some new equipment has been introduced and carried on board. A major piece of medical equipment is we did not have defibrillators aboard the ship. We now have those defibrillators aboard all naval vessels so that if there is a heart condition, people can remedy that. So there were a number of changes. And then procedurally, the Navy looked at what tools are we giving commanding officers when they pull into these ports to be able to make the right force protection decisions. And for a while, you saw a much increased flow of analyzed intelligence information going to commanding officers to allow them to make a far more informed decision when they pulled into ports. But unfortunately, I think as time has gone on, familiarity with nothing happened breeds mm-hmm. a little bit of contempt. You're now beginning to see that the intelligence is not flowing as much down the chain to the commanding officers. They're once again being directed in some ways into ports that pose a danger, told to follow certain procedures without being given the background as to why they should follow them, what the training and tools are that they should have to use to carry out those measures. And so consequently, I think we're beginning to approach that point again where Navy ships are going to once again be vulnerable mm-hmm. to these types of attacks because we're not giving the commanding officers the intelligence they need.
I think complacency unfortunately sets in when nothing happens.
It's the first casualty anytime you have budget issues.
That's very true. As a matter of fact, we've got about a minute and a half to go as time has gone by quickly again as usual. Is there anything that you would like to tell our audience? Any final thing that you would like to say?
Well, the one thing I would first and foremost like to do is thank you for running this program and thank your audience and listeners because while I may have been blessed with a great crew on the morning of October 12, 2000 when we were attacked, I know that we could not have done what we did that morning, and those young men and women can't do what they need to do out there defending our freedom at the tip of the spear today without the thoughts, the support, and the prayers of Americans back here at home who help them, but more importantly, support their families who literally live day to day wondering if their loved ones are doing okay. So on behalf of your listeners, thank you for everything you did for my crew and for me, and thank you for those young men and women that are out there protecting our country today.
There you go. So, Commander, where can we get a hold of Front Burner?
Well, there's a couple ways to do it. First one I'd tell folks, go to my website, which is kirklippold.com. That's KirkLippold.com. And it has links to all of the major places that are carrying it, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. For those that enjoy the audio version, I was privileged enough to be able to self-narrate the book, so I narrated my own book, and it's available for those that listen to books on CD or books on their MP3 player. Those are all available. So those are pretty much the major venues that you can order the book from.
Okay. Thank you so very much, Commander Kirk Lippold, author of Front Burner, Al-Qaeda's Attack on the USS Cole. Thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio.
Absolutely. Thank you, and thanks again to your listeners.
Thank you. Well, we've got another one in the books, as they say, another great story about America's heroes out there. Until next week, you are dismissed.